on the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur, because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. I hope you're having a great day out there, making some money, learning some lessons, helping some other people, being gratitudinous, having gratitude for all of the things that we are blessed with. And you have to acknowledge that we are blessed with quite a lot if you're listening. Fantastic show for you today. Three great things. First up, Aaron Koop. A new book called I Can Fit That In, a great way to think about time management and priorities. It's a great conversation. Then we're going to play a quick 10 with Dave Burnett. And then Joanne Lipman, one of the most famous Wall Street Journal journalist, is with us. She's moved on from there. But anyway, you have a great show today, and thanks for being with us. Let's get started. Very excited to introduce my first guest. Please welcome Aaron Koop to the show. She is a speaker, author, and executive partner. She is focused on helping high achievers transform and prevent burnout and have some clarity, energy, and fulfillment there instead. She had two decades working in Wall Street in the corporate hell and decided to have her own transformation. We will ask her about that. And she started her business. It is called Authentically EC for her initials. And she's just published a new book called I Can Fit That In. I Can Fit That In. Oh, I get it. Aaron, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks, Jim, for having me.
Tell me about your corporate hell.
Oh, my corporate hell. Well, I spent 17 and a half years in Fortune 140 companies, starting at Reuters, moving into Goldman Sachs, and then CBRE. And, you know, one of the things that I really felt was a quality of life that I had, you know, sort of adapted over time was constant overcommitment, perfectionism, and ultimately that level of overwhelm that just felt like I was burning out every single day. I would call it Groundhog's Day, you know, and we all know that famous movie with Bill Murray that we love.
Love it.
And yeah, right. And like every day just felt so monotonous. Like I'd wake up and go, oh, I'm going to do this all over again. You know, and what's interesting is it wasn't just about the work or the environment, but it was about the way I was navigating all of it. I was living my life in this hamster wheel where nothing ever felt that rewarding or that fulfilling. And I was always striving for more, always chasing something that was just out of reach. And that led to what I would call a cycle of self-sabotage, where just nothing ever felt that good in life.
Okay, well, maybe that was the fault of the big company, the corporate Leviathan.
Yeah.
What were the things about it that were getting to you?
So, you know, one of the things I can speak, you know, in particular right now about Goldman, and then I'll move into some of the others. But, you know, one of the things there was that there was definitely a vibe, at least in the group that I was a part of, that the leadership that I reported into, or I should maybe say the lack of leadership, was one in which they were put in those positions of leadership because they either had the most tenure on the team or they were just paid at a level, you know, VP or above, where they had to give them more responsibilities. So that's one thing I noticed early on in my career is I would look around at these people that I was reporting to, that colleagues and peers of mine were reporting into, and all of us had the same complaints. There were a lot of very sort of inhumane ways that we were being treated. And there were, you know, things that were occurring where, you know, we were working 14, 15 hour days, which that culture was definitely one in which that was necessary. At the same time, we didn't have to be treated like, you know, people were projecting their insecurities onto us because we were young and smart and hungry. You know, we were trying to do the best we could. So I definitely dealt with that level of leadership style that was just very insecure and fear driven and ego driven. And that never felt right because, you know, especially as at that point, I was an early, you know, early stage career professional in my 20s. And I would look around thinking, gosh, I never want to be like those people. I just never want to. And so I took it upon myself over the years to invest in leadership style courses where I could learn more about what true leadership is. Now, that said, as I did step into leadership at CBRE years later and was a vice president there, I made sure that I did not treat others the way that I was treated. You know, I did not think that it was my rite of passage to treat others poorly just because I was treated poorly.
That's the whole fun of it, though, is to do unto others as they did unto you, you know? And that's how corporate like hazing gets passed from one generation to the next, you know? Yeah. You're supposed to be miserable.
Right? Yeah, as long as you stay miserable, then that means that I'm doing well. That was definitely a mentality that existed, and I could not disagree with it more. And ultimately, it is why, and I know we'll talk a little bit about my own transformation, but it's why I chose to walk away from corporate after I was doing some deep work on myself for a few years and realized I am shifting in ways that impacts my entire life, not just professionally, but also personally impacts, you know, motherhood for me and my relationship with my children, impacts my marriage and my relationship with my husband, impacts the way I show up in my community and my friendships. And then, of course, where I spent most of my time was at work, and it was absolutely impacting the way I was showing up at work for my team, but also the clients I was attracting. And so, you know, it did not go unnoticed, some of this positive change that was occurring in my own behaviors. But when people started to notice, when upper level management started to notice, they were like, hey, can you help us change the culture around here? To which my response was no, because I can't help you change culture in something where you're perpetuating this cycle of, you know, egotistical driven leadership. And so I did end up walking away so that I could do this work on a broader scale.
All right. Tell us about your transition then.
Yeah. So, I mean, I call this inner work because there's really no better term for it. But, you know, if we think about human behavior and the ways that people, you know, what I call just show up, the way that you show up at work, the way you show up in your family and your communities, that has a lot to do with how you feel about yourself on the inside. It has a lot to do with your thoughts and with your feelings. Thoughts and feelings tend to match each other, right? The energetic vibration of those thoughts and feelings are usually in tune with one another, right? So if you're thinking something negative, you're going to feel something negative that matches that thought. And I came to a realization that a lot of the way that I had been showing up in my relationships at work, at home, et cetera, was not necessarily who I was or how I wanted to show up. Therefore, how I wanted to feel was not what I wanted to feel. So if I was to do anything about it, it's me and only me that can do that. And that was a huge change because I'm going to be honest and vulnerable right now, but historically I was so good at pointing the finger at other people or other situations. You know, I could point my finger and blame this person or that, you know, the nasty client or the person that cut me off on the road or the barista that made my coffee wrong or whatever it is. I was very good at doing that. And I would say most people are, right? It's way easier to look outside yourself for where to blame or where to say the problem lies than to look inward. Sure, and so looking inward was the big change that I made. And once I started to say to myself, I'm responsible for how I feel. I'm responsible for what I think. And if I want to feel different every day, I have to do something about that. It's no longer, you know, my husband or anyone else that is the problem. And so it became something I would say was like almost like a hobby. I would change ways of leading my own life. So for example, instead of getting home at that point and pouring a glass of wine at 5:30 when the nanny left and saying, oh, this helps me take the edge off, which, you know, my days did feel quite edgy at that point. But instead of relying on that habit of taking the edge off, I instead chose to be fully present and put my phone away and just be with my kids for 2 hours and not let anything distract me. And it was really hard. I mean, that was not an easy choice to make at first, but I had to get myself used to something different that would then help me think and feel differently, right? It's like the age-old saying of you don't change ways of behavior or ways of leading, you know, your own life with the same way ways of thinking. You have to think differently in order to do that. So that was one change I made. Another one, you know, instead of watching, you know, Netflix every single night, I was instead meditating or journaling or reading. And it wasn't cold turkey. I'm not saying there's no such thing as perfection. It was just slow progress of, okay, you know, two nights a week, I'm going to do this instead of that. And I'm going to see how I feel the next day. You know, I'm going to see how I feel because of that. So little small shifts were helping me get in touch with myself and be honestly just more in tune with my heart, more in tune with, you know, the heartbeat within me, the spirit within me, the light that can shine through me. And as I became more in tune with that, my life started to reflect it on the outside.
So talk about the book specifically. I can fit that in how rituals transform your life, and you have routines crossed out and replaced with rituals. What's wrong with a good routine, and how is that different from a ritual?
Yes, that's a great question. So, you know, here's the whole point that I make in the book about routines is that there's nothing wrong with routines. In fact, rituals and routines have a lot in common. They are a structured, repetitious rhythm. Both are the same in that sense. The difference is that routines over time can eventually become numb. They become draining because they become autopilot. They become something that we think we have to do and just check it off the list versus something that we want to do or something that delivers meaning to us. And so when we do a routine because it's just what we've always done, we are blocking out wonder. We are blocking out possibility. We're blocking out evolution within ourselves because we just stay tied to some certain thing or some certain way of being that may no longer serve us. We may grow out of it. And it's hard to recognize that when you're just in that monotonous autopilot way of being that I described earlier that I used to be in, right? When I was waking up every day and everything just was the same, it's because I was stuck in that autopilot, you know, just every day I was doing the same things. I wasn't thinking differently or behaving differently. So what rituals are instead, they're still structured, they're still repetitious, there's still a rhythm to them, but they're chosen in whatever moment you choose them because they add value or meaning to your life. There's something that you choose because you actually intentionally want to, not because you have to. So they're not about checking the box. It's not saying, okay, so journaling might be a nice ritual that I have in my life. Do I have to do it every day? No. Do I have to do it at the same time every day? No. Is it on a to-do list? Absolutely not. I'm not checking the box. I'm doing it when I feel like I want to, like it's going to do something for me and or it's going to connect me more with others. So rituals can also be done with colleagues. They can be done with your family, with your partner, with your friends. And I talk a lot about how rituals can also be seasonal, right? Like we go to the Caribbean for a holiday present for my family every year. We gift this gift of experience and we go to a different island the first week of January. And we've been doing that for 10 years. And that is one of our family rituals, you know, so it's something that can also connect you more deeply with other people and also connect you with the planet, you know, things that you may do outside, you know, you might go bird watching or you might, you know, enjoy long walks just without a phone or without, you know, listening to anything. You know, you might actually do something like paddleboarding or kayaking, whatever that is, but something that connects you more with the world around you as well.
I love that. I love that tradition of a new island every year. My family goes to the same island every year. So,
oh, nice. Which island do you go to?
Cayman.
Oh, I love that one.
Oh, I've quit going. I'm so tired of
St. Martin's phenomenal. We've been there a few times.
My favorite by far is Jamaica.
Oh, love Jamaica.
If you're going to go on holiday, yes, you might as well have Jamaican consumables. And so,
yeah.
I like what you said about it. It doesn't have a checkbox to go with it. So rituals are not things that get put on a checklist.
Right. Absolutely. That's right. And that's why I named the book, I Can Fit That In, because my whole point is one of the biggest shifts that I made, that I've helped clients make, and that I know that readers can make with this book, is to be able to say, I can fit that in. It's not about doing more. It's about being more intentional. So a big part of I can fit that in because it matters to me is I can remove the things that don't. The things that drain me, the things that do not add value to my life, the things that are siphoning energy away from me or life force away from me, the things that are distracting me from what I want to give attention to, that's the stuff that we have to be way more purposeful about. And some people think it's just, no, I need to put more in my days and stack all these routine habits and these biohacks to be more productive or more fulfilled. And then they end up just so exhausted. Well, of course you do, because no, you only get 24 hours a day. No one's more special than the next person. So if 24 hours is it, what do you have to do in order to really feel more fulfilled? And it's very personal for each person. It's not the same things, right? So designing your own rituals helps you understand what are you going to remove at the same time so that you can put in those things that matter and fit those into your days. And so that's where I tell the stories of myself and clients about what they had to remove in order to fit in the rituals that are really going to help transform their own lives. And that's a key step, is cutting out the stuff that no longer serves you.
So as you started getting out in the real world, how did you build your firm?
Authentically EC.
Yeah. So
yes.
Talk to me about building out that company and what it offers and how you market it. Just tell me the whole story there.
Yeah, sure. So, I would say any, you know, entrepreneur who is doing something they're passionate about. I started doing this before I launched the company full time. So as I was in corporate America in that VP role that I mentioned earlier, I was doing the work on myself. And within a couple of years, the shifts were so profound, and that business that I was in commercial real estate was growing in a way that I was, you know, sort of just amazed by. It was more profound growth than I had actually set out for. And I believe that was because of the work I did on me, right? I was shifting how I was showing up. Therefore, the world was reflecting that. And as that became more successful, I thought to myself, geez, I have realized all of this positive change. And if I can help more people with this kind of change in their lives, then the world will be a better place. And I just felt like I had something bigger to do on this planet. And this was a part of it. It was as if my soul was saying, you know, you've got something you've got to offer to humanity. And if you don't, you're going to regret it one day. So I started to do just that. I started to talk to people about this inner work. I started to coach people, because as a lot of people that knew me were noticing the shifts in me as well. So they were like, wait, what are you doing differently? So I started to coach certain executives in my, you know, sphere of influence. And it was proving to be very successful. I then started to share a lot of this on LinkedIn, not, you know, specific names, but just various stories of things that were really impacting people's lives and the way that they were leading in the professional world. And it was taking off on LinkedIn. This is back when we used to write articles, not, you know, posts in the feed. And so people were reaching out to me saying, hey, can you come and talk at our town hall about this? This is really interesting stuff. And then I would do that, and I'd be asked to do a workshop, and I'd do that, and I'd be asked to coach a team. And so it really led to this organic level of awareness and reputation that I didn't necessarily plan for. So that's where all the work started on the side of my corporate gig. I then went on to do that for a couple of years and was making changes in my life as any entrepreneur would, where I was shifting the ways that we were spending money. I was shifting the ways that we were budgeting, because I knew that some point soon I was going to step away and do this full time. And, you know, anyone knows that you're not going to make, you know, great money in your first year. Unless, you know, maybe you are if you invent a unicorn product, but that's not what this is. So I knew I had to make some changes in order to really step away from that stability and security of, you know, the financial system I was a part of in corporate. And so I launched it full time, early February 2020. It was, you know, as I said during that time, it was either divine timing or chaotic timing. I would say it ended up being divine, because what I didn't plan for, but quickly could adapt to, is making it largely an online business for, you know, the early stages of the pandemic. And I probably did, I kid you not, about 60 speaking engagements in the first year and a half. And they were all online. They were all virtual. And it really got me so many reps with delivering the human skills related content that I had created that was giving people tools to make shifts within their own lives. And so the things that I speak about, of course, now I do this on stages and in corporate settings all the time, but I speak about topics like self-awareness and emotional intelligence and authenticity, energy and productivity and redefining success. And a lot of these things that people want to know more about, but what they really want to know is not just informationally, you know, tell me some things. They want to know what they can do starting now that's going to make a difference for them. So in every engagement, I give 3 to 5 tools, and one might resonate with one person, but 5 might with the next person. So everyone gets something that is applicable to them, which is pretty, what I've been told in the feedback is that that is just so successful and so helps people keep accountable to what they learned and what they heard in some of these engagements. So yeah, so I do tons of these workshops, tons of speaking engagements. And then I also coach teams within corporate settings and or, you know, sometimes smaller businesses. I mean, I've worked with PR firms that are 10 people to, you know, the Deloittes and Microsofts of the world. So it really runs the gamut. And I think the beautiful thing about this work is that it is not about a certain type of demographic or a certain gender or a certain background. It doesn't even know an industry, because this is about humanness. This is about truly relating to yourself and to others in a way that feels more meaningful, more connected, and just overall more fulfilling.
Excellent. I love the way you say that. And so do you have a pitch that you're using to encapsulate all of that? What's the elevator pitch to express that to a conference coordinator?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things, this is really interesting. So I just delivered my talk, I get this, on Pub Day. So the day the book was published was November 5th. And I delivered a talk called I Can Fit That In, The New Rules of Sustainable Energy, Capacity, and Performance. And with that pitch is exactly what the book entails, but what my work entails, because the book is an extension of my work, right? So the way that I talk about that is we are helping people to increase their level of performance and sustainable success by helping them understand how can they create more capacity in their lives. You do that through the intentional changes or shifts within your own mind first, and then the shifts in the way that you give your attention, your focus, and your energy to the things that you choose. So that's really the pitch. And you know, I've got the write-up on the website. I've got one pagers on that. And that is something that not a lot of people out there are doing, and not in the way that I am, because rituals, the way that I describe them, this is your new operating system. The old operating system doesn't work. The old operating system is about burn yourself out until you're 65, and then you get to live your life. And we all know we've seen people die long before that, and or, you know, become so unhealthy that they can't do anything after 65. So we're no longer buying into that notion that that's the way we're going to live our lives. We're going to live them now, and work is a part of our lives. It doesn't have to be, you know, let's move on from the day, you know, the day job. It's not about not making money or not doing anything. It's about enjoying all of that while we can.
100% true. How do we find out more? Follow online, Erin, get a copy of the book.
Absolutely. So my website is erincoupe.com. So that's ErinCoupe.com. I am on LinkedIn under Erin-Coupe. I am on Instagram at AuthenticallyEC. And a copy of the book, it's available everywhere that books are sold. You can get it online at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Books A Million, Walmart, you name it. And you can also buy it directly on my website if you want it signed and with a custom bookmark.
Fantastic. How'd you get your publisher?
So I did a hybrid publishing arrangement. And, you know, ironically, I knew a lot of people that published with traditional outlets, you know, the Penguins and the Random House, et cetera. And one of the things I learned about that is it can take quite a while to get your book in the world, you know, 3 to 4 years. And I'm the kind of person that once I commit to something, like I want to do it and I want to do it well, but then I want it done. I don't want to have to sit on it for a long time. So I researched that industry and thought that's not really the fit for me, but you know, maybe there's another solution besides self-publishing, because I also didn't have the time for that project. So the hybrid world is a great fit. You know, it's a mixture. They're a service provider. So you pay a fee and they provide you a service to manage your entire project and get your book published. So that's what I chose.
Excellent. Erin Koop, thank you so much for being with us, and we'd love to have you back. Thanks a lot.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jim.
And we will be right back. We are back and have another brave contestant willing to play the Quick 10. Please welcome Dave Burnett. He is the founder of AOKmarketing.com. If you're interested in starting to talk about internet marketing in an AI world, Dave is the guy to talk to. Dave, I heard you were willing to play our little game, the Quick 10.
Absolutely. I don't know what I'm getting myself into, but let's bring it on. I'm excited for it.
All right. Do you want to accept the standard wager?
Say yes, then. I would like to accept
there
the standard wager.
Yes, you would like to accept the standard wager. Great. Are you currently sober?
I am currently sober, yes.
All right, great. Number one, your favorite creativity hack?
My favorite creativity hack, honestly, sounds boring, but reading something I'm not familiar with just gets my mind expanded. That's what I like to do there.
Number two, favorite bootstrapping trick?
My favorite bootstrapping trick is to get other people to pay for my client acquisition costs. So that means spend a little bit of money, making so much money off of them after, you know, I get my first client that they pay for the next clients we acquire and keep acquiring clients. It's called client financed acquisition. It's a great, great trick.
Number three, name your top passions.
My top passions are learning, family, and spending time on a lake, wherever I can.
Number four, the first three steps in starting a business are?
Give something away for free. Once you've figured out what that free thing is, then you execute on that thing. Tell the people that you are executing on that you suck at it, and all you want from them is a referral and or a review. And then once you've done that for five or 10 people, and you got 5 or 10 favorable reviews, then you start to actually charge money for that thing that you're doing. So those are the first three steps. Give away something for free, get referrals, and then start charging.
Number five, the best way to get your first real customer is?
That same whole process I just talked about. Give them away for free.
Number six, your dreamiest technology is?
Something that answers questions that before I even ask them, it knows what the next question is.
Number seven, best entrepreneurial advice.
Know that it's going to be hard.
Number eight, worst entrepreneurial mistake.
I didn't get it in writing. That was a huge mistake. Always get it in writing.
Number nine, favorite entrepreneur and why?
Warren Rustand is his name. Favorite entrepreneur. He's my mentor. He's an amazing guy. Everybody should look him up and follow everything that he says.
Number 10, favorite superhero.
Well, not really a superhero, but I'm a big fan of Speedy Gonzalez. If you remember him from those old cartoons that we used to have. And the reason why is my grandfather used to call me Speedy when I was a kid. So he's my favorite. And he always used to win whenever he was running away from things.
Fantastic. Great answers, Dave. Very interesting. While we calculate the score and find out the winner of the wager, how do we get in touch with you and find out more about AOK?
Yeah, just go to AOKmarketing.com. Do you want to find out more about me? Happy to connect on LinkedIn. So just find me, Dave Burnett, on LinkedIn. And otherwise find me on X. I got some thoughts there, but nothing earth shattering, but that's the other place where I'm at.
Fantastic. Dave and I had a really interesting conversation trying to figure out what do you call search engine optimization for the AI world. And we, you know, the market is sort of coming up with GEO for generative engine optimization. So it'll be interesting to find that out. Dave and I had a great interview talking about all sorts of things, including his cool stories. He bought 3,000 URLs one day. It's a story worth listening to in the longer interview. I'm just kind of pausing, Dave, while we count. Oh, I'm so sorry, Dave. You got a 94, which is an excellent score, but you have to have a 95 to win. One of our judges from Minnesota dinged you. I guess that's some sort of lake rivalry or something. I don't know what that is, but you being Canadian and all, you got dinged. So I'm very sorry that you did not win. Excellent answers, though. So you do owe us a Tesla. As always, we're playing for a Tesla. So I'll look forward to you sending that real soon.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, you forgot about the conversion rate. So 94 US is actually 120 Canadian. So technically, I won.
No, I think it goes the other way. 94 is Canadian, like 68.
Yeah, well, no, but we were playing in US dollars. So that's where I'm just trying to say when
no,
you
convert. No, we're just playing
it,
in single so. Teslas. So.
Okay.
I'll take
all
a
right.
Canadian well, Tesla.
You'll take a Canadian. Well, that's harder to do given that they're manufactured in the U.S. So we'll see when they start coming here. We'll have another conversation. How does that sound?
Dave Burnett, thank you so much for being with us. Great fun, and thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jim. Really appreciate it.
And we will be right back.
Well, that's a wonderful question, actually, Jim.
Oh my gosh, I love the opportunity to do this. Thank you, Jim.
Wow, that's a great one. You know, that is a phenomenal question.
That's a great question, and I don't have a great answer.
That's a great question.
Oh, that is such a loaded question, and that's actually a really good question.
School for Startups Radio.
Welcome back to School for Startups Radio. I hope you're having a great day and using today to somehow make yourself a better person, a better entrepreneur, and someone more likely to succeed. Remember, my favorite piece of advice is to take your remote control and place it underneath a rock 100 times and then throw away the pieces and never watch television again. Very excited to introduce you to my next guest. Do you like that one, Joanne? I think TV is such a waste. My next guest is already laughing along with us, which is very good. Her name is Joanne Lipman, and she has had every job in journalism it seems possible. She started off as a reporter for some small paper called the Wall Street Journal, worked her way up to the editor of Page One, and then editor of the Weekend Journal, and then deputy managing editor. And then she was the founding editor of a Condé Nast publication called Portfolio, and now she has a brand new book coming out from Hyperion. You don't get any more prestigious than that. It's called Strings Attached, and it is a, I don't know if it's a parenting book, but it's certainly a book on raising children. Joanne, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm excited to learn about you and your book. You know, this is one of my favorite topics because I got three kids, 16, 14, and three. And so I am very much into this. Tell us, what is the thesis of your book, Strings Attached?
Sure. So Strings Attached tells the story of one particular teacher, a quite extraordinary teacher who changed the lives of thousands of students. But in a larger sense, it really is a book about all of us. It's about the mentors that we all have in our own lives. So it tells his story, which is a quite dramatic and quite remarkable story of success and trauma. He had a lot of tragedy in his own background and somehow transformed it into this incredible legacy of success. So it's a kind of a wonderful read. It reads like fiction. But that we really thought hard in writing the book about what are the lessons, what can we take away? You know, how do we create a culture of excellence? What can one person do to become a mentor and create excellence in others?
Wow. Okay. I love it. Is it possible to create a culture of excellence? What are your thoughts?
I would believe so. You know, what's interesting about this particular teacher, he was my childhood music teacher. He was a very, very tough teacher, really tough. And this is what's been kind of fascinating. I'll tell you a little bit about the genesis, and then we can talk a little bit about the culture. The genesis of the story was this man was my childhood music teacher. In New Jersey, he spends in New Jersey. name is Jerry Kaczynski, which we could not pronounce, so we called him Mr. K. Now, he was the toughest teacher ever, literally. He was this Ukrainian immigrant with a big, booming accent. He was the guy, he was the orchestra conductor, and he was a guy, if he heard one person playing a wrong note, he would stop the whole group, and he would yell, he would say, "Who is idiot who played wrong notes?" You know, he was the tough guy. I had lost touch with him after I graduated from high school. And yet, decades later, when I heard that he died, which was just a couple of years ago, it hit me like a ton of bricks that this man changed my life. And that while I had given up the viola, which is what he taught me 25 years earlier, that I used the lessons that he taught me in terms of things like focus, discipline, and perseverance. And I used those lessons every day. And by the way, when I went back, I felt compelled to go back for his memorial service, which was a concert performed by some alums who studied this whole concert. I dug my viola out of the closet after 25 years. I felt so compelled that this man had such an impact on me. And I also thought I was a little nuts that I had a strong reaction to this. But when I went back to that little concert, walked in for the rehearsal, I saw 30 years worth of former students who had flown in from every corner of the country who felt just as I did. And we that day put on a memorial concert when the curtain rose on us for the size of the New York Philharmonic. So you see how what the impact that one person can have on so many lives.
All right, Joanne, I hate to be the jerk here, but today he would be fired and run out of school for being abusive, wouldn't he?
Well, so yeah, this is the trick, right? He had really, really tough methods, and most of which you play with today. Now, certainly nobody, no teacher would call a kid an idiot today, and nor would any parent stand for it, including me. But there were other methods that he used in terms of strict discipline, and I can go through, you know, we kind of deconstructed some of his methods that we can learn from today. I mean, I can give you a few examples. He never gave us unearned praise. There was no false praise. In fact, it was very little praise at all. His highest praise was not bad. And if you got a not bad, you went dancing down the street, you went home, you practiced twice as hard because you knew you earned it. And what's so interesting about that is that the latest research that's actually come out since he passed away shows that that's actually right, that the latest research, and there was just something on NPR last week about this, shows that when you overpraise children, it undermines their confidence. And that when you instead praise them for hard work, it encourages their confidence, that they are more confident, and they actually perform better academically when you praise them for hard work. And it was as if he knew that intuitively, and it kind of instills confidence in the kids. Another big of his methodology was he allowed us to fail. Again, something that doesn't happen these days. He had us audition all the time, and sometimes we did well, and sometimes we didn't. But he never focused on the outcome, and he never, ever penalized us for failure, ever. It was all about how will you improve for next time. The focus was always kind of about how we can do better. And by the way, what he would say to us, he didn't say, listen to me or do what I say. He would say, discipline yourself. Transfer responsibility to us for our own actions. And I think that both of these kinds of things really can translate today because the bottom line, it wasn't abuse. The bottom line, it was optimism. It was he believed in us. He was conveying to us, believed in us and in our abilities do better, and in our ability to pick ourselves up again when we fail. And he developed those qualities. And I think, actually, that was one of his former students, now a very, very successful musician, said to me, he said, the single most important lesson she ever learned in life, she learned in his classroom. And she said, he taught us how to fail and how to pick ourselves back up again afterwards. Such an important life skill, no matter where you go or what you do.
Well, that is very important, Joanne, especially for all of us entrepreneurs. You know, we are constantly getting told no. And I think the most important skill of an entrepreneur is being able to just let that wash right off your back like a duck and keep on going. So I love this, that he taught everyone to, you know, persevere. That is fantastic. Let me ask you this, Joanne. One of the people that wrote a blurb for your book was Amy Chua, who is, of course, the famous author of Tiger Mom, the very controversial book about Asian and certain specific children. Do you believe, as far as Amy does, in how strict a life that her children have had? Or do you still believe that getting dirty and playing in the mud is good for kids?
Oh, I'm definitely playing in the mud. I'm definitely in the playing in the mud camp. But this is very interesting. We've been out talking a lot about the book and doing some interviews and readings. And someone in a audience at an event made a really interesting distinction between what Mr. K did and what the Tiger Mom approach is. And she was absolutely right. But the difference is this. Tiger Mom's approach is, my child has to beat your child. My child has to be better than your child. Mr. K's approach was, I want my students to always improve themselves. We were not compared to each other, and it wasn't about beating anyone. It was about improving ourselves. So it was all kind of within ourselves. So I think that it's a very, very crucial distinction. I also think that the qualities that you mentioned earlier are so interesting for entrepreneurship. One of the things we did with Strings Attached is we interviewed a lot of former students, some of whom had gone on to become musicians, but most people like me, most had gone on to become business people and entrepreneurs and doctors and lawyers, and you know, they'd gone into other professions. But I asked these people, so many of whom came back, you know, dropped everything in their life to come back to pay their respects and play in this concert. And I said, what was it that he taught you? And the qualities they were meant that they told me were exactly the ones that you just mentioned. Perseverance, resilience, self-motivation, self-confidence. Those were all those, that is exactly kind of what he instilled in us. And that doesn't come from Tiger Mom. That doesn't come from beating up on the other guy. That comes from within.
Yes, it does. Big, big, big distinction there. All right. Let me ask you this. Was Mr. K loving? You talk about how hard he was. Was he also loving? You said he didn't give much praise. What about other ways of giving love other than praise?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I'm really glad you asked that, because the reason he was effective was not just because he had a big stick. It was because he had a huge heart. And he had a real sense of gratitude to this country. You know, he was born in Ukraine. He had a quite tragic childhood growing up during World War II, when separated from his parents, and he ended up in these really dreadful refugee camps, and he was on the run from the Nazis and from the communists. I mean, it was a really tumultuous childhood that he overcame to get here. And when he came here to this country, he was 19 years old. He spoke no English. He loved music. He first heard music, violin, played by actually one of the occupying German soldiers in his village, and had fallen in love with music, not just because it had an affinity for music, but because of what it represented. It represented an escape. It represented another world where there was beauty, grace, and, you know, so unlike, transported him away from this death and destruction and chaos that he was living in. And yet he'd never learned music by the time he got here, because he was always on the run, and his, you know, he was separated from his parents. And so he gets here at the age of 19, can't speak English, is taken in by a Ukrainian family who invites some other Ukrainian families to meet the new immigrants. And one of the people, one of the Ukrainians they invited, happened to be a college professor in Kentucky, of all places. And this college professor says to him, I'm going to take you back to Kentucky with me. I'm going to make sure you get English lessons. I'm going to make sure you get a college education. And the amazing thing, by some divine twist of fate, this professor happens to be a professor of music who taught the violin. So Mr. K had such gratitude for this country, even with everything that went on with him, and he passed that on to us. So he would do things always. He would take us to perform at nursing homes, at hospitals, and not just play, but he would insist that we stay afterward and circulate with the patients. Because he said, you know, they're not, they don't see a lot of joy. They don't see a lot of young children. And he actually would say, and you will stay and you will like it, is what he used to say. And we did. And it stuck with us to this day.
Joanne, I ran a summer camp back in the 90s at Stanford and MIT, Georgetown, UCLA, a bunch of places like that. And the first week, I only had 19 students at my summer camp. And I was afraid that if I gave an award ceremony that lasted 3 minutes, you know, gave out three awards, that the parents would be PO'd that they had driven from San Francisco all the way to Palo Alto for 3 minutes. And so I decided to give every child an award. And we came up with silly awards, and all 19 kids got an award. And one of the students' parents was actually an education professor and wrote a paper about this, about how wonderful it all was. I think that that was the birth of this horrible practice of every child getting an award. What would Mr. K say about that? And every child getting an award, what does it do to your expectations?
Right. So he was the opposite of that award, trophies for everyone kind of culture, totally the opposite of that. And I believe for good reason. I mean, there is research on this too, actually, about this for everyone. And in fact, there was research done very recently on music students, on band students, I think in Michigan. And the researchers followed a group of music students as they auditioned and were placed in, you know, first to last, and in some of them in the lower level bands and whatever. And they wanted to see what was the correlation between placement and self-esteem. That's what they were testing for. And what the researchers found was that the kids' self-esteem was fine. The kids were fine because they didn't want a trophy if they didn't do well. They didn't want that false affirmation. They said that, so the researchers said the kids' self-esteem was fine. The problem was the parents, the teachers, they freaked out about it. But our kids are more flexible than I think the culture has been giving them credit for.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Definitely agree with that. What about entrepreneurship? I believe very intrinsically, Joanne, that the bad things that happened to me as a child are what have made me a successful entrepreneur, that I have a chip on my shoulder to prove to those people who picked on me as a kid that I can be successful and do good stuff. And I believe that failure as a kid is great. What do you think?
I agree. Again, when you have failure as a kid, you have trouble as a kid, and you have to figure out how to overcome that. That is a skill you will use for the rest of your life. It's really hard as a parent, and I have kids too, and you have three. You know what it's like. It's really, when your kid is struggling, it's so hard to watch. And you really want to jump in there and save them so they don't have to experience that. But the fact is that having them navigate those troubles on their own is what will that is a skill that they will need and use for the rest of their lives. And I actually had a conversation with a fellow, with a woman I know, who said that and she's a woman now, like in her 50s, but she said that she was grown up, she grew up with parents who wanted to protect her at all costs from failure, from distress. And she said that it was the best of intentions, but she said she feels like it's undermined her confidence for the rest of her life. She's afraid to take risks, that she doesn't have confidence in her own judgment. And she's kind of recognizing this, and I think she's trying to do something different with her own children.
Has this changed the way that you're parenting, Joanne? Not necessarily the experience with Mr. K, but the real reliving of Mr. K's lessons after his funeral. Has it changed you?
It has. And in writing Strings Attached, I co-wrote it with Melanie Kuczynski, who is Mr. K's daughter. I led a Chicago and the two of us were together, and we tell his story.
Can't hear you, Joanne. Joanne, can't hear you.
Can't hear me?
You dropped out for 10 seconds.
Oh, am I there now? Am I back?
Yep.
Great. The co-wrote with Melanie Kachuk, who is a violinist with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. She's Mr. K's daughter. And we wrote in alternating voices. And the experience has changed both of us in that we really had to think long and hard about what was it that made him effective as an educator? What was it that, what were the lessons of success that he taught us, that the students have taken with them? And then it made us rethink, between the two of us, we have five children, made us rethink how we work with our own kids. And my husband and I have always been very set on having our children kind of navigate their own problems for themselves. Like, we really did our best to not interfere at school and to let them deal with it for that very reason. But it did really make me kind of rethink the idea. You know, I'm sure I've given more false praise, empty praise than I should have.
Right. Well, I just found it was so much easier just to let them go when they're four. You know, when you're four, at their four, they're done. You've raised that child, Joanne. You can set them out on their own then. You don't have to worry about them after that. Right?
Yeah.
That's so funny because, you know, I was a good kid. I was an easy kid. I was never happy, but I was good for my parents. And I didn't really give them any trauma until I was like 30. And then I gave them as much trauma as they could handle.
Delayed adolescence for them.
Well, it wasn't, you know, it's just life fell apart at 30, you know, and who do you rely on then but your parents? All right,
yeah.
We're about to run out of time, unbelievably. When you say strings attached, what do you mean by that? Obviously, there's the music metaphor, but what are you trying to say You were saying that you shouldn't be too involved and too active in your kids' life. So what does that analogy refer to in your mind?
Oh, yeah, it has multiple meanings. I actually love the title. It has multiple meanings. Of course, you know, he was a string teacher. That's the basic one. But I think that the idea that this was a teacher who launched me and so many students years and years ago, and that many of us have forgotten about but realized his influence on us. And I think that the idea that we're still connected to him, we're still connected to each other. My co-author and I, who had also lost touch for many decades before we reconnected, you know, have reconnected in this wonderful way. And the music, the connection of people who play music together is so strong and something that comes back to you and that you were very fortunate to have. So I think it sort of works on every level of connectedness.
Will you force your children to do things they don't want, like learn the viola?
Well, I did make, my sisters were also students of Mr. K, and the three of us have been seven children, and all seven children were required to take music lessons. They weren't required to stick with it, but one of them has gone on to become a professional French horn player, and the others have stuck with interest in the arts, and, you know, it's really been a great thing for them.
Well, Joanne, we have run out of time. Other than going to Amazon or Barnes & Noble's or their favorite bookseller, how should people reach out to you, circle you, all of that kind of thing?
Sure. So you can get the book in any of those venues. And also, there's a website. It's stringsattachedbook.com. And you can get more information. There's some of the music from the book, actually, is embedded in the site. And also there's a form. If you wanted to reach me, you can actually send me a note. I'd love to hear from you.
Fantastic. Joanne, thank you so much for being with us today and continued great success with the book.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
All right, me too.
We are out of time, but back tomorrow. Be safe. Take care, everyone. Bye now. Oh, and go make $1 million. Bye now.